this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word. It is thanks to our patrons, those who donate on a one-time basis or on an ongoing monthly basis. It's because of your financial pledges that we're able to continue to keep this podcast free to the rest of the world. And we want to thank each and every one of you listeners for tuning in week after week with all of the unique and interesting people we have that are on the podcast from week to week in each of these episodes. It's always a lot of fun to chat with friends, and I have known many of these people for so many years, and this week's guest is no different. This week we're going to be talking with a magic dealer, Joe Stevens, who is the owner and proprietor of the Stevens Magic Emporium in Wichita, Kansas, which has been open probably, I think it was since 1973, I believe is when he said that he had opened. And anyhow, he gives us a lot of interesting background. There are a couple of things in this podcast episode as you're listening that I want to kind of apologize for, because one of the things I wanted to talk about was his Gemini network. Right, you have to understand that Joe has really been a trailblazer as far as going out and doing a lot of interesting things before any other magic dealer started doing them, which has now become something that is kind of commonplace. And one of them was the Gemini Network. And that was something that was well before its time, that basically was an online forum. And there were only a couple of others that were out at the time that allowed magicians to interface with each other over the internet without sending emails. Well, basically, it was a forum. And they had regular people, regular contributors who would publish essentially articles. They would take a lot of time to put these things out there. So it was an online free thing. I don't know if it's free or not. I can't remember if he actually charged. I think there may have been some sort of a monthly fee, but I don't recall. So we didn't actually get into that, but it was just another one of those things that Joe Stevens at Stevens Magic Emporium had done. And also, let me just say that this is not a long one-hour advertisement for Stevens Magic Emporium. It's just that Joe Stevens has offered so much to the magic community for over the years, and he is a friend to so many. And I know that a lot of you have seen him at magic conventions and have ordered something from him or purchased something there at the convention. But, with the Desert Magic Seminar and the other things that he has incorporated with the Greater Magic Video library and other things that he has done, it's just been groundbreaking. And the stories he shares this week are really good too. One of the people we talk about in this week's episode is Nick Ruggiero, who was one of the co-owners, along with Rich Block, of the Collectors Workshop, which was later sold then to George Robinson down in McAllen, Texas. But anyhow, we talked briefly about Nick Ruggiero, and I said that I would like to get together with him because Joe had mentioned that he was not doing well physically. Well, since this episode was recorded, that Nick has passed, unfortunately. So just kind of goes to show that time is always of the essence and that you should always grab the opportunity before it's gone. And unfortunately, that Nick is one that is gone. But Joe is around, and he has been for, golly, what did he say? Let me just say, several years. And he's still working then as a proprietor at Stevens Magic Emporium, along with his son, Mark. And Joe comes into work every day and working 6 days a week. In fact, when we talked, that I had to chat with him over his phone line at his office, but I couldn't get to him until after Saturday afternoon when they actually had shut the shop down because that they keep busy throughout the week. Well, anyhow, enough hearing from me. Let's hear what Joe has to say. So please welcome my guest and good friend here this week, Mr. Joe Stevens, here on The Magic Word. You just get to pretend, Joe, like you're looking at my handsome face.
Well, now, wait, I haven't seen you for a few years. Wait a second.
It has been a while, so just remember me the way I was. Remember my Christmas pictures, I guess, huh?
You all do. Oh, and I miss your wife. Oh, God bless her.
Yeah.
What a lot of fun we had laughing about those pictures, the cards that you all took.
Well, you know, I have to say, and that's I have done those over the years, 30-plus years, and I've got to say that you were instrumental in inspiring me to put out those Christmas cards. We put out a first Christmas card, and it was the one in which that she was peering over my shoulder, and it looked like that. I mean, she just had a necklace. It didn't look like she was wearing anything, you know, behind me. And I remember that you had replied saying, "Well, I think I know why you're smiling, Scott." And I thought that was funny. And so the next year, I reversed it such that I took off my shirt, and then I was standing behind her. And then I thought, okay, well, I've got two. It's kind of like a collector, right? You know, when you're a collector, if you've got two of anything, then you've got to have three, and then the ball starts rolling, right?
It starts going.
And the same thing with this. And so we just had fun each year trying to figure out, well, what are we going to do for our cards? And sometimes we'd plan, you know, far in advance while we were in the summer and vacation or wherever we were, or we'd see something that would spark our imagination saying, that'd be a funny card, you know, something we'd do. But then the replies I always got back from you, man, I could always expect each year to receive a nice some reply from you that would make both of us smile. So I'm glad you enjoyed that.
It was good. I enjoyed it. She was a lovely lady, classy. I liked her. I didn't see her that often, but it was fun. The relationship spawned and grew. And how long ago was that when she passed away?
She passed away in 2018 on May the 2nd, so it's just been a couple of years ago.
2 years.
Yeah. Still what seems pretty it? Fresh.
What type of cancer was it?
Brain tumor. She had glioblastoma. So they gave her, after they diagnosed it, they gave her 13 months, and she lasted for 12. So they were pretty much right on. And they'd said that it's not curable, but it's treatable, you know, so they can kind of make life pleasant for a while. So that was it. But, you know, our friendship, those go back for years and years and years, obviously way before that. And when that we had first met, I'm trying to think, it had to have been at a magic convention, because I know that you've been attending like forever. I mean, when did Stevens Magic Emporium first open?
Well, we opened in 1975.
Okay. And before that, I recall you telling me that you were a Fuller brush salesman. And when I've talked to people about that, they just kind of blink and say, I don't know what a door-to-door salesman is, let alone Fuller brush. And as I recall, Fuller brush kind of had a full line of things. You didn't sell vacuum cleaners, but it was kind of like a Sears and Roebuck catalog kind of stuff you sold, right?
Oh, every year they had all kinds of brushes and cleaning supplies and aerosol room deodorants and cosmetic, like the Avon company. It was a huge company. It's a very strong company, but of course now with things changed. Mm-hmm. I was with them 22 years.
Wow.
And boy, did I learn a lot. I only took the job, they guaranteed $125 a week.
Yeah.
Out of college, I said, come on, I'm only going to work a few months, so I go to work. Well, I was making a lot more than that, because people received you. They knew the Fuller Brush men, like the Avon ladies. And so Martha and I got married, and that required me to keep my nose to the grindstone.
Right.
So I stayed with them, kept making money, and I got a promotion, and stayed with them, got another promotion. I was 22 years. Ended up one of the regional managers for the Midwest part. And so we earned a lot of money. We worked hard. Martha helped me, you know, with the ordering and whatnot. It was sort of a family thing. But the time came in that time frame, things changed in America. Factories started paying tremendous wages. And so...
you mean like the Ford Motor Plant and places like that, just
manufacturing? Yeah, well, in Wichita, it would be Boeing, Cessna, Beech, the aircraft industry was paying great money. And when I started, $125 a week was damn good. But 5 years later, it wasn't too good because the industries in Wichita were paying more money. So it was harder to find people to get into direct sales. But nonetheless, after 22 years, I got up to be a branch manager and enjoyed it. And they paid me a nice salary. But
Going door to door, I mean, you quite literally were going and knocking on doors, weren't you? I mean, you weren't making phone calls. You were just walking down the street with a
That's
suitcase,
right.
basically, right?
We were assigned the area of Wichita, each one of us. So I had my area over in the Riverside area. And that's what I worked. Every 4 weeks, I would make the rounds again and call back on the same people. It wasn't every day or every week. It was every 4 or 5 weeks. So we had territories assigned.
Mm-hmm.
And
then you took orders. I mean, you didn't sell necessarily out of the bag. You said, okay, well, if you want these, then we'll take your order, and then they'll be shipped to you.
Yeah, we got the merchandise from the company, and then we would deliver it to the customer.
Oh, you did? I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the best days that we had, and were snowy days, bad weather days.
People couldn't get out, and they would still want to buy
something. That's right. That's right. If they were more receptive to us, and but after you call on people every 4, 5, 6 weeks, they get to know you. You get to know them, so they're not afraid. So you build your business that way. So I only took it for a part-time job, but the money was so good we stayed for 22 years.
But the experience that you learned as far as making sales and how to talk to people, how to listen, when to shut up, and that kind of a thing is where you learned that.
You got where you could read facial expressions. You could their eyes, their facial expressions. You could tell if they were frustrated. If that's the case, well, I'll catch you next time around.
Yeah,
because you can't talk to people if they're not in a receptive mood.
Mm-hmm.
But you strike up and build a relationship with these people. Now, not everybody bought, but more people bought than didn't. So if they didn't buy after a couple of times, or they were resistance to the type of selling we were doing, I just scratched them off, didn't call on them again. But we had a lot of people. I had customers every time I went by for 4 or 5 weeks would buy. What did they buy? A hairbrush, a can of room spray, toothbrushes. There was always something that they buy every day somewhere. We just happened to catch them, and they bought from us.
Hmm.
So, but after 22 years, that industry changed. And in 1975, I wanted to always have a magic shop. So we opened up a magic shop here in Wichita.
Well, were you doing magic? I mean, when you were going and doing sales, I mean, were you kind of putting in some tricks to kind of entertain people, like with jokes, basically?
I did that with the kids, sure, of course.
Okay.
And they loved that, and that built a relationship. But when I decided to leave the Fuller Brush Company, we were making good money, so we started the magic shop, and I stayed with Fuller. I stayed with them for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and Martha worked the magic shop, and it wasn't just magic. She had gifts and plants, novelties, jokes, and gags.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever sell adult novelties? I mean, I know some magic shops, in order to stay in business, seems like that they had adult, like a little closet or section. Did you ever go that route or not?
We had a section of gag jokes.
Okay.
They weren't pornographic. They weren't X-rated. They were just funny stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The novelty type things. You open the lid and something would spring out of it. See?
Exactly. Uh-huh.
And so it wasn't really
adult risque, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. It wasn't X-rated.
Well, was that the same shop location where you remained for all the years?
Yes, it was at 3238 East Douglas.
Mm-hmm. So you had a good relationship, and still do, I'm assuming, with the leaseholder.
Well, we moved. We sold the business. We sold our costume business. We were big in costumes, too. Costumes, magic, novelties, and jokes. Halloween was huge, so we made a lot of money.
Did you close down the magic side of the business during Halloween the way some magic shops do?
Yes, we did. We packed up the magic, and we did.
And focused on costumes.
Yeah, they understood when they came in, because they would come back if they would come in to get a set of linking rings. They would, and we would pack them. But they'd come back in 2-3 weeks, whenever the season was over with.
Well, now, back then, really, the only major magic brick-and-mortar shops was like Tannen's and you, and there probably wasn't but a half dozen or so across the country that really didn't do a lot of mail-order business. It was mostly walk-in. Isn't that right?
That's right. The Jean DeVoe in St. Louis, Abbott's up in Golden, Michigan. There was a magic shop in Kansas City, Magic and Novelties, Louis St. Pierre out in Hollywood. But it was, you know, walk-in business. But mail order got so big. I mean, it just transfigured itself. It changed.
Did you advertise then, like in Genie magazine, I guess, back then?
Yes, mm-hmm. We sure did. We sure did. And then, so we built a mailing list. We had a catalog we started doing. And Connie Little here in Wichita was our graphic artist, and she was brilliant. She put out a little 36-page catalog, and we'd get the addresses of our magic customers, and every 6 weeks we'd send them a little catalog.
Mm-hmm.
And boom, 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 that thing was just, in fact, that is I think that, of course, now with the internet and our website and our catalog, gets us 90% of the business.
Wow, today, 90% is all online, as opposed to the other 10% is just walk-in business.
Yeah, online.
That's hard to keep the doors open, I think, with just that small a business, but unless there's just a huge amount of online business.
Well, yeah, it's very difficult to compete if you don't have access to, if you have a website, and if you're not doing the emails and getting your customers' email addresses, it's very hard to compete anymore. So
But there's a lot more competition. I mean, whereas there used to be, that's what I was kind of getting at, that back then there weren't that many brick-and-mortar shops, whereas today there are lots of online shops, because anybody who wants, it's almost like you want to be a magician. Well, you go to Stephen's Magic Emporium, you buy three-card Monty, and you have your business cards printed the next day, and you're ready to do a show the following day, you know.
That's right.
Similarly, with online shops, it seems like that you can just get an account then with a wholesaler, then you can create your own website, and boom, you're in business.
Absolutely. It's so easy now. So anybody can become a magic retailer, dealer. And even though they're not full-time, they can do it part-time, and they siphon off business from those who are doing it full-time.
Yeah.
I'm not against them, because we have stuff, items that nobody else has.
You do have proprietary things, and that's what I've always really enjoyed whenever I go to, or used to go to conventions and see you there, and then Mark, and then other people, you know, who were with your standing behind the booth. Always had something a little bit different that you brought from overseas, because you really got to travel a lot. You had associated or affiliated with some other creators who you sold. You were the sole proprietor, I guess, for selling their items and everything.
Fine. So. Yes. Well, the Ken Brook line, we paid $10,000 for the Ken Brook line.
That's a good investment.
Oh, it was, because he was one of the leading magic people, dealers in England, London, England. And all the pros went to his shop, Fred Capps, Ali Bongo, all the old-time pros visited his shop, and I kept hearing his name, Ken Brook, and Pete Byrow was responsible too. Oh, Ken Brook, he sells blah, 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 blah. So I finally got a chance. Ken was in failing health, and I ended up buying the line, and we paid $10,000 for the Ken Brook line, which is still today amazing. It's those items from those creators will play forever, because you've got Capps's Nemo 1500, you've got Capps's Floating Cork, you've got so many of the great items that Ken Brook, you know, put out. So,
well, he must have been doing kind of what you were doing back then over in England, that is, of associating with some of the greats who would come to him with certain ideas, and then he would be have exclusives with that.
Yes, that's true. But he didn't carry crap. He carried good stuff, and his instructions, he was, oh, man.
He used to write his own instructions, didn't he?
That's right, but he put the plus in his routines, and Pete Byrow kept talking about him, and then I heard Jay Marshall talk about him, and I heard all these people talking about Ken Brook, and then when I had the opportunity to, he was wanting to sell the business, I jumped in and bought it, and so this carried us, and it's still, to this day, Scott, we still sell a lot of the Ken Brook Magic Range items. Very professional. Very professional.
Now, Supreme was not part of Ken Brook. That was a separate company, is that
separate.
Right?
Separate. Uh-huh.
Okay,
because
I know they had some things.
Ken Brook worked for Hooper, and then he went off out on his own and opened up his own studio.
Okay. Well, I remember meeting Ken Brook one time, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like he was at Siegfried and Roy's home whenever that they sponsored a party over at his place.
Oh, yeah, the backyard. Yeah,
the backyard.
Yeah, you got to meet him. You sure did. Before he passed away.
Yeah, and I remember him just crying, and he was so thankful and wonderful to be there, and he was just a very emotional fellow.
Yeah, you remember that, don't you?
Yeah,
it really meant a lot to him, because he met Brother John Hammond, Vernon was there,
Slidini, Christian Fechner, Ricky J.
Yeah, they were there, and he was just in heaven.
I think it was 84.
You got me. I thought probably. it was about. Let's see, we opened in 75. It was It was around 81 to 82, 84.
Well, kind of going back on that, that wasn't obviously your first dance, but maybe you had been doing some other things, and I was going to ask about that. I thought that you had something in Wichita that was an early convention in the 70s, and I want to say 78, 9, somewhere in there, and when David Copperfield had come in.
You're right. He came in the late 70s. I was with Jay Marshall at Abbott's in Colton, Michigan convention. Mm-hmm. David was just blossoming out, and he did a stage act. And Jay and I were sitting on the front row, and I said, damn, he's good. And I was looking for somebody to bring into Wichita to start a little small conclave for magicians.
Yeah. So what made you want to do that? I mean, were you just trying? What was the idea?
I don't know. I just love magic so much. The bug had bit me so bad that when we opened the magic shop, I just dreamt about bringing lectures in, and we bring different guys, and why not bring some stage acts in?
Yeah, but Wichita is not necessarily a destination city. You know, a lot of conventions, of course, will try to have, like, Orlando or Las Vegas or someplace. But, I mean, Wichita, Kansas, I'm sure people are thinking, what?
Why there? They did. But when you get a name like David Copperfield, they did come.
But he wasn't the name, as you said, back then. I mean, he probably just finished his show in Chicago.
Well, when I saw David at Abbott's, he was just blossoming out.
Mm-hmm.
When I approached him after the show was with Jay, I says, Mr. Copperfield would like to bring you to Wichita and do the stage acts for us. We're going to have a conclave in Wichita. And he said, well, just pay me my fee. The fee was $10,000. I says, okay, we'll do it. And I gave him a deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And but he wanted him to do two shows that day on a Saturday. And he said, no problem. So he came, and he had a great time, and we struck up a relationship with David that to this day is still very well respected for both of us. Yeah. And that kicked it off. But the first convention we ran was a Wichita conclave, and I just wanted to do it because there were different conventions. St. Louis Jubilee was going on over there, and mm-hmm. Chicago had something, and IBM and SAM had something. I said, well, I'd like to try to do something in Wichita.
There weren't as many conventions back then as there are today, that's for sure.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. But even though today, Scott, those conventions aren't doing as well as they used to. Look at your attendance at the IBM and SAM.
Well, absolutely. You know, like the TAOM, too, as I've said several times, when I was president of TAOM back at Texas Association of Magicians in 2000, that was the last time we had over 1,000 registrants. We had like about 1,100 and something. And today we're lucky to get about 300 to 400 people, you know. And it used to be larger than the IBM and the SAM. And even they, too, individually probably can't draw but about 300 or 400 people.
So you're right.
He says it's tough to have a convention of people to congregate.
Now, why do you think that has happened? I'd like to hear from you.
Okay. I'm usually asking questions, but thank you. I'm glad to. I really would like to discuss that. But I think it has a lot to do with the way people have learned to socially interact, specifically that we're able to buy things online. We can practice online. We have YouTube where we can interact with people. We have Zoom conferences or Skype or whatever. We want to talk to somebody and physically. I don't think that people like to get out as much as they used to. It could be that they're not making as much money to travel to these locations. Everything has gone up, it seems like, obviously, just the general cost of living as far as transportation and your living expenses while you're there at the hotel. Even if, like, whenever I was younger, would be sharing rooms with other guys, you know, to defray expenses. But hotel costs have continued to rise along with travel, as I said, and registration fees have gone up. And even so, it's just gotten to be to a point where a young person who would be the one who you're really trying to attract really can't afford that. And I think that's evidenced by why you see so many close-up people as opposed to stage magicians. I don't think there are a lot of stage props that are being sold as there were in earlier days. I don't think necessarily that Mac Magic and some stand-up kinds of things necessarily are being sold. I may be wrong. You're a dealer. You might correct me on this, but it would seem that there are more close-up things because people can understand. It's not a trick box or a trick can or whatever,
right.
But you can carry a deck of cards with you a lot easier and do card tricks. And so younger people have that ease and of entry into this. And so I just think that it's a matter of finances and economy, of whether that people, you know, can get in. And as I said, because of social interaction that people can get through Facebook and through other social media and everything, that they are not necessarily as interested as they once were of physically going and seeing people. I mean, I, you know, could hardly wait for the next convention, you know, to get a chance to go to the dealer's booth and, you know, see what you got that's new. And I would actually come with a list. There are some things that I have seen in magazines. I really want to see how this looks. Of course, this was prior YouTube. And so I want to actually see you demo this. And it's like, yep, that's what I want. You know, so I'll check these things off. There are things that I might buy in addition to that. But as a pro, you got a general idea of what you want to buy. Well, now that you can buy anything anytime and you can see it demoed and you can decide whether or not that you want it. And so why do you need to necessarily go to the convention because of that access? Anyhow, those are a variety of reasons why I think that you don't have the attendance today that we used to.
I you hit the nails on all the on the head, all of them, because what we are, we want to, what motivated us back then and even today, we need a magic fix. But back in those days, the fix was going to a magic convention because you got to see them live, you got the dealers demonstrating, you bought magic, you could meet it, stay up all night doing card tricks with Roger Clouse.
Exactly right.
So you got your fix, but now you get your fix every day because of what's on the internet and on the, you know, the Genie magazine, the IBM Thinking Ring, the SAM magazine. It's easier to get your fix now, so you don't have to spend all the money because the costs have gone up for air travel, hotels, food, registrations. Another thing that always sort of ticked us guys off as dealers is a lot of the conventions let any and all dealers in the conventions. So now, it sounds selfish, but when you do that, the amount of business that you do is watered down. If a, you know, a convention has 10 dealers and you have 1,000 people, those 10 dealers will sell a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But when the convention attendance drops a little bit, you bring in 20, 25, 30 dealers because that was revenue for the people running the conventions, it waters the business down. So it didn't get to be too profitable to fly to Boston, Massachusetts for an SAM convention and pay all that money, hotels, food, meals, travel, and your business was less because there was more people in the, more dealers selling.
Yeah, it's a good point. If you have, well, for one thing, back when it was 1,000 people, it'd be different. But then having 500 people and the same number of dealers, you've got less money to be distributed among them, and they're trying to give more of an experience to the registrants by having more dealers. So let's say that you before had 20 dealers for 1,000 registrants. Now they've got 40 dealers for 500 registrants.
There you go.
Makes it even worse.
There you go. Now, I also understand, because I haven't been to an IBM convention or SAM for several years, at the number of dealers at the convention are not near what they used to be. Is that true?
That's true. I think that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I had gone in earlier days, there was a huge room, just with rows of magicians. Seems like you can go down, and now they're contained to smaller areas. Yeah.
Yeah, and because you paid for dealer space, you can have one or two tables. You got your hotel room. You got your air trip expenses. I remember Obi was chastising me for not going to. I said, Obi, it doesn't pay. It sounds selfish. I don't mean it bad. I love to go, too. We meet new customers and show off new stuff. But it doesn't pay to work 5 days, kill yourself, to break even. In some cases, don't break even.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to get that through Obi's head that it doesn't pay anymore. It's just not. It's because as the put a catalog out like we do. We're one of the only few now still putting out a catalog every 8 weeks. Why you get to, we get more business from the catalog than we ever sold at a dealer's convention.
For those who are listening to this, by the way, that Obi O'Brien at the time what you were talking about was the dealer chairman for the International Brotherhood of Magicians convention. So he was the one who was trying to solicit and get more dealers, obviously, to come to the convention. So, yeah, I can understand why he was talking with you and saying, hey, you need to come. So, yeah, that makes sense. So then you transitioned from after a couple of years. Why did you then decide to go to Vegas? I mean, it was obviously a great choice, but did you feel like that you would bring more people in if they went to Vegas, or you got too large for Wichita, or you had bigger plans, or did someone, Siegfried and Roy invite you to come out, or what happened?
No, it's better than that.
Oh, wow.
But you're right. You hit the nail on the head. So we did a couple conventions in Wichita. We call them Wichita Conclaves. And then a Crabtree and I forget Klaus said, let's have a close-up convention. Just close-up. That's it. So we had what we call the Southwestern Wichita Close-Up Convention here in Wichita. And the Texas boys came up, and they were very good. We had good support. Vernon came in for it. Fawcett Ross came in for it. We had 100, maybe 125 people total.
Well, Fawcett Ross just lived up the road, though, from you.
Yeah, St. Joe, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a just close-up. And what we brought in as a hook, so to speak, I use that word with respect, we brought in the Las Vegas magicians, Las Vegas magic in Wichita. We brought in Daniel Cross, Mike Skinner, all the guys that were working at the hotels came in, and we matched them up with the Klauses and the Bob Whites, and we had plenty of talent,
mm-hmm.
but the Las Vegas magic in Wichita. And after it was all over with, Jay Marshall said to me, you got it all wrong, Joe, bringing the Las Vegas into Wichita. Take the convention to Las Vegas. And I said, you know, you're right.
So it was staring in the face the whole time.
Yeah, Jay was right. So we went the next year to the Aladdin Hotel, and we booked the same guys again, but it was different venue, and the people came from California, the Magic Castle, you know, my God, and Vernon came. And so it was a success by moving it to Las Vegas. That's the showcase of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so that started it off, and it grew, and it grew. And then Siegfried and Roy were not involved the first couple times that we went to Bay, 2 years. And then one night at Gary Darwin's magic party, Wednesday night, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Wednesdays, right.
At midnight, Siegfried comes in, and because he loved magic like we all did.
Yeah.
Sitting at the table with Siegfried, and Martha and I are talking to Siegfried. And Siegfried says in his German brogue, why do you not come to our show? We didn't go to the show. We didn't think about going to the show.
Yeah.
And Martha sort of nudged me, and I said, well, Siegfried wanted to know why we didn't publicize Siegfried and Roy's show.
And as being part of the convention when you come to Vegas?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Uh-huh. I said, well, if we do, you've got to do something. We don't want to just use your name to, and then people are disappointed that you're not teaching magic or lecturing or having a talk. And so Siegfried says, tell me what you want me to do. And so we give him ideas, and he says, we'll do it. Roy and I will do it. So Siegfried wanted to be, and God bless him, I give him the highest praise. He loved magic, and he wanted to do whatever he could do to make magic successful. And that's obvious because they were successful.
Oh, yeah, sure. So they gave back a lot to the magic.
Yeah, and that's what he, that night when he says, what can I do? I want to be a part of this. So we said, well, maybe we can meet you after your show and have, I wasn't promoting dinners and parties or anything. Maybe we can something to do. I said, we'll meet you after your last show, and we'll have a few drinks over at, where the hell was, I can't remember. He said, that's fine. Well, Roy and I will meet you after our show. So we did. And we went over to the hotel where they were after his last show at midnight at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
They bought everybody drinks.
Mm-hmm.
Were there, and so that started. And then at the end of that, I says, "Well, thank you very much for what you did." And they, I could tell they wouldn't do it again. Well, next year, if we do it, we want to do something a little different. So give some thought to what you think you would want to participate in. I never ever said you need to do this. Can you, It was up to them.
And you just kind of gave them, carte blanche, saying, we're in. We want to do something with you, too. What's your idea? Yeah. And let them kind of run with it.
That's the beauty of it. They wanted to participate in it. And so it wasn't that I sold them on anything. The venues sold them on participating because it was good for Magic. So Slidini and Vernon came there, too. And Siegfried loved spending time with them. He's like you and I, Scott. He'd do anything for Magic.
Right.
And so that's how it started, and every year it got bigger, and every year they wanted to do more, and to give them all the credit, they're the ones that were the catalyst for the thing growing as big as it did.
Yeah, because they eventually then had their Sarmody Lion's Head Award.
Yes. Yes, that came up, and they wanted to do that and present the winner with the cash. Mm-hmm. Although we supplied the cash, they supplied the statues, their time.
But that then culminated in going to their home, and that was one of the big attractions. I mean, it got so that the Las Vegas Desert Seminar became really a social event of the season. It wasn't just a convention where you go and see some top acts and people competed who have now gone on to greatness, Michael Weber and Pat Hazel, you name it, so many different people who had competed and won awards, but also just the fun things. I know that Martha had a lot of impact as to suggestions like, hat night, I think, or something, and different kinds of themes that we had for the parties and things. I remember some people say, well, that's really not a convention. It's just a big party. It's like, well, that's what a convention is about. That's what I loved about it.
That's right. And when Martha got with Roy, because he wanted to do something, and a date with Roy.
Yeah.
For women only. No men allowed.
Uh-huh.
And all the ladies had a time. And Roy did everything for them. They paid for the party for the ladies, the dinner, whatever they did.
And got nice.
And the ladies enjoyed it. The men couldn't get in.
Yeah.
So every year that thing grew and grew and grew. It gets the chemistry of the thing with all the people that wanted to participate. Made it a big success.
Sure, because a lot of times that I believe that particularly the ladies who are not magicians are left out at magic conventions. It's like, okay, well, you can go shopping. You can do something else. They got to find something else for them to do, or else they just don't come to the convention at all. But your convention was very inclusive before others. And I don't know that others really have ever reached that same level of the bar you set way back then.
They may have tried, but they could never compete with Roy and the date with the ladies.
No, that's true.
And
but that one year in 1984, I was referring to when we'd all gone to Siegfried and Roy's house, one of the other reasons that was a big attraction to me was an opportunity to come and see Fred Capps. I've never met him, and that was the year he was going to be coming, and then he had taken toll on him, and he had to cancel at the last minute, and then he died a few months later. I never got a meeting, but I've always had nothing but the greatest of respect. That was one of the people I'd love to have met.
Oh, you, Scott, he was something else. We brought him to Wichita. Before the Vegas thing for our last convention here. It was in 19, hell, I can't remember. But I spent a week with him. He came in and spent a week. So I'm alone with him for, five days. And then the convention started. He was so different. He thought, I said, where do you get your creativity? Where do you, all these things? Well, first of all, he was dedicated to magic, like we all are, and he mm-hmm. spent time. He said, well, when I come up with an idea, he said, if I was to buy something, I'd put it up on the mantelpiece by my fireplace, and I look at it for about 6 weeks, thinking, how can I present this effect that's different and unusual? And I'll never forget him telling me that. He thinks it. He thought about all these ways, the best way to present his stuff. But now I tell you, that was, I think that was after that year we tried to bring him to Vegas, and that's when he got sick.
How did you first get to know him? I mean, I know he was a good friend of yours, but where were you? I mean, were you at like the Magic Hands Congress or someplace or overseas?
No, I think it was Jay Marshall that said, I was talking to Jay about who to bring. And he said, who's the best in the world? It's a crazy question. He says, Fred Capps. Fred Capps.
First thing out of his mouth, that's what he said.
Yeah, Fred Capps. He can do it all. Still close up, stand up, stage. So I got his phone number, and I called him on the phone in Holland. I says, Mr. Guy, introduced me, blah, blah, blah. We'd like to bring you to our magic convention here in America next year. But what would it take? And I remember his words. Just pay me my fee and cover my expenses. Hmm. And he told me what his fee was. I says, no problem. So we did. And he came, had a great time, because I think Vernon and Slidini were here, too, at the same time.
I'm sure he liked being with his with those people, kind of rubbing shoulders.
Mm-hmm. He did. He did. They would sit at nights in the restaurant talking. And I'll never forget, I was there. Just, I keep my mouth shut when he was talking.
What a session. I would love to have sat in on that.
Yeah. And
you're lucky.
A guy came up out of nowhere. I don't know who the hell he was. He says, Fred, Mr. Capps, I want you to show me this move here that you blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And Fred looked at him, and Fred knew him. And he says, you can show me because I'm a magician. And Fred said, sir, you are not a magician. You are a painter. And so the guy just shut up and walked away.
Wow.
Now, Fred didn't say that in a meaning way. Uh-huh. He just didn't want to waste time with somebody that wasn't at the status of Vernon Slidini himself and the rest. And they were sitting at a table, you know, eating or having a drink, and the guy interrupted him, and that sort of teed Fred off. But I'll never forget that. You are not a magician. You are a carpenter, a painter. I forget what that was. Mm. But Fred was a nice guy, humble guy, and it was too bad, too bad.
Well, yeah, as I said, never got to meet him. Well, there are other people I remember that you had aligned with, and there was, if I tell you the trick, you might remember the fellow who had invented this, and he, you'd sold a lot of his things then as well, and I picked this up, I believe, at one of the seminars, and that was, it had like a joy buzzer built into it. It's a little box kind of a thing, and then it looked like it had some wires and things, so it looked like a gimmick of some sort. And then when you take the back off of it, you'd wind up the joy buzzer, but when you put the back magnetically, you know, back on there, it had the a playing card. So this way you'd force a card, and then you'd have someone, when they pushed the button, it was like a thought transmitter, and they could, the other person was who they were, who was seeing the card, would know what the card is. You can kind of play back. You know what trick I'm talking about? Does it ring a bell with you?
Yeah, ring a bell. We still sell them. It's a great item. It's called the Comedy Mental Transmitter.
It's wonderful. I did this at the meeting a while back, and people said, I've never seen that before. And I said, this dates way back, and I could not remember the gentleman's name who made that, invented that. It was some friend of yours. I want to say from overseas.
Bob Austin. Bob Austin with the Comedy Transmitter.
Bob Austin.
Yes, he was another English magician.
That was it. I remember him being overseas, Bob Austin. Okay.
Funny bit, if presented right and you get people involved, entertaining, it's comedy, and it's got mystery in it, too.
It does. I was just kind of going through stuff, and I was dusting off something. I looked at that, and I said, I haven't used that in years, and I kind of fiddled around with it, and they loved it. Everybody kept saying, where did it come from? Bob Austin, that was the guy. Okay.
Yeah, great item. We still make them today.
Mm-hmm. And so I know that you became associated then with Rich Block, because I had performed at his Magic of the Summit in Washington, D.C., and that was a fun time also. And I could see some similarities between his convention and yours and why that you guys had finally merged, and similar personalities with just being very congenial and likable people. I've stayed at his home and visited with him many times and just love him and Suzanne. And I remember going to a backyard party with him one time with Harry Blackstone Jr. and Charlie Reynolds and others. And I was thinking, boy, what am I doing here? You know, we're all having hot dogs and hamburgers, and it was so much fun. He's just such a great, great guy. But how did that mashup come to change?
Well, that's
from
a
the
good
magic
question. You do very well with the history. You got a good memory. That was I had bypass surgery. I had a heart attack, and I can't remember now when it was, but it was at 5 bypasses, and boy, I slowed down, and I was just going too fast, too much, mm-hmm. And so Martha and I talked about it, and I said, well, running the Desert Magic Seminar was a lot of stress and a lot of work, and although I loved every second of it. And
I know that Bill Wells and Pete Biro and others had helped you with that, too.
Yeah.
But even so, it's a lot for even a staff.
It was just putting it all together and working with the magicians, different ones. And after that, it took me a few months, quite a time, to get back to normal. And Rich and I had a separate one time, and I just mentioned to him that I don't know how it came about, Scott, I don't know, but it came up about selling the Desert Magic Seminar. And Rich said, okay, how much? I told him. He said, no problem. And so we sold it, but we still retained the ability to, or the participation to be involved on the committee with Rich, advisor and whatnot. So we sold it. I got rid of the stress. Martha was happy. And we still could participate and see all of our friends, see Siegfried and Roy and Lance and all the people. So Rich bought it. He and Nick Ruggiero,
bought the
event.
Back when they had Rich, Collector's Workshop.
Yes, Collector's Workshop. And they ran it for a few years and did real well. And then I guess Rich just decided not to. That was sort of the end of it.
Yeah, it did just kind of fade away. I mean, it wasn't any big bells and whistles or anything, you know, like Magic Magazine had done with the end of their 25 years or whatever, you know, with the big accolades. I mean, it was just one of these things that after 1 year, they just didn't have it the next year and just kind of stopped having it. So that's why I kind of wondered what happened. I guess that I know that Rich and Nick eventually had sold the Magic Collectors Workshop and that guy in West Texas bought it. This company now.
Who was it?
George Robinson now has it.
Oh, yeah, George.
Yeah.
Right.
So George has the company then now. So what's Nick doing, by the way? I haven't talked to Nick in a long time. I remember.
The last I heard, he wasn't doing too well.
Mm.
And
okay. I might need to get in contact with him sometime.
Yeah, you better do it quick because his mind, I understand from Rich, it's hard for him to remember things.
Well, that's too bad.
I'm sure he'd love to talk magic with you.
He was the one that I had, who had suggested to me to put my posters in, keep them flat and put them in plastic bags, and I just stored them under the bed because I went up, he took me up to the bedroom, we slid these out and started going through a bunch of posters. In fact, I think he gave me one or two, which I had still have in my collection. But anyhow, yeah, just a great guy that might want to try to touch base then, you know, with him. But yeah, now, of course, during the conventions that you were the only dealer, I mean, as opposed to like other conventions where they invited other people in. So but was there a dealer room? I can't remember.
Yes, we did. I was the only dealer for a few years.
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. Of course, it grew. And then we opened it up to, and we selected the dealers we wanted. It wasn't anybody wants
to. Kind of like Abbott's does, I guess. Abbott, well, of course, they got people selling on the streets that they can't control. But, I mean, those that are actually the other dealers in the gymnasium, you know, they select.
Yeah, we always, and I think I can pridefully say the dealers we invited were good, honest dealers, reputable, and they had a different line. They were specializing in this and that and whatnot. And we let them in, and we at the end we had 15, 20 dealers from around the world. So it was good. It didn't bother me to say, let's have some other dealers come in and get a piece of the pie. Because it was an attraction, as you know, in a convention, the dealers, the performers, the lecturers, the venue are all important to have a successful event. So by having more dealers, even though we sold less, it was okay because it brought in higher registrations, which compensated for the loss of sales.
Yeah. It was sometime then, Joe, also back around that time in the mid-80s that you developed then the Stevens Video Library. What was that called?
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
The Greater Magic Video Library.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I remember there was a fellow who was a host who was a local television personality, I guess.
Yeah.
Was, okay.
You got a good memory, Scott.
Guess,
I'm impressed.
And they used to shoot in their studios at the TV station.
Yeah. Gene Rump was a local television celebrity and radio guy. Mm-hmm. And he loved magic. Gene got into magic, and he'd perform on the side, too. And so Gene was the one that said, you ought to start shooting these guys for doing their lecture.
Oh, it was his idea.
It was his idea. Huh. And I says, bingo, you got a good idea. And so Gene, he developed the first video and Carol Fox was the first one. And from then on, getting Carol, who was a leader in the industry, everybody wanted to, that we asked. Well, we wanted to pick, you know, the top ones. There was no problem. We paid them the fee. We paid their expenses, and they came in and did a one-hour show for us.
So, it's interesting because I was curious about that, of whether, Joe, that people back then were concerned about doing this, because I know that they were still lecturing. Remember, Bob Carlback used to, before I started doing this, and I took it over from Bob as far as booking lectures, people on a tour. And back then, there were a few people lecturing, and but for the most part, they could only be seen really at magic conventions.
Right.
Names like Carol Fox and some others. So how did they feel when you would approach them to say, would you do this? Because they may feel, well, I'm giving this up, and why would anybody need to attend my lecture when they could just buy my video?
Well, yeah.
Did they have that as concern to express to you?
Not really. Maybe a little bit, but it never surfaced to me because I never had anybody say no.
Interesting. Okay. Well, you're Joe Stevens. I mean, who'd say no to you? You're such a nice, likable guy. Ask him
about
that.
Thank you,
I'd give you the shirt off my back, personally.
But the fee was fair, in fact, more than fair, and so it just, we got lucky. What we touched always came around and was successful, but Carol was the first one, and that was, I picked him because he was so well known, and then it was easier to get the next one and the next one, and as the thing went on, everybody wanted to be a part of it, because after all, Scott, all they're doing is teaching six or eight tricks. And they're getting themselves a pretty sizable, nice sum of money.
Right. Back then, as far as the compensation, in addition to cash money, did you also just say, okay, we'll give you some videos you can have that you can sell if you're going to be lecturing?
I don't remember doing it, but I probably did. But it was never part of the contract. It's never part of the deal.
And that. Well, now, as I recall also that you were doing those on a monthly basis, and, I mean, there were so many people for a while coming in, and then you had the Baker's Dozen where that you could get 13 for the price of 12, because you had this was a subscription basis kind of a thing. I mean, you didn't know what you were getting necessarily for the next 12. It was like a magazine, basically.
That's right. They didn't care. So we, but all the talent, I like to say all the talent we brought in was they didn't have to worry about getting somebody they didn't like.
Oh, yeah. Larry Becker, Michael Lamar, I mean, you name
sure.
it, yeah.
All of them there. So that we were the leaders in that. Now, where did I get that idea? Hans Zahn in Canada? He started the first video.
Hmm.
And when I found that out and saw some of his stuff, I said, you know, that's a great idea. I got to give him credit. It's nothing that I found on my own. So we started the Greater Magic Video Library. But he was the first one, though, that did it.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't last long with him.
Now, how many total videos do you recall you put out?
Oh, there is...
in the library.
Almost 40.
Wow.
Almost 40.
And those since been digitized, obviously, I guess?
Yes, the DVDs. And we sold the rights to the Greater Magic Video Library. We sold the rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again...
So tell me some stories. There has to be some things where people in the early days were coming in and they didn't quite know exactly how to perform in front of a camera, because that's different when you don't have a big audience. Because it's like L&L has an audience, and I don't recall that that you did like they do.
No, we did. We did.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah, because we brought them in, and the people that we asked are local magicians and their friends and their wives. They wanted to because it was a great form of entertainment for them.
Sure.
Because Tom Mullenkamp would come in, for example, and he would do his shtick, and everyone went rolling on the floor laughing. So it was a great show for our spectators that would come. It wasn't hard getting spectators.
Mm-hmm.
And the studio, the KAKE-TV studio, they set up the scene, the stage, and the curtains, and Gene Rump was responsible for that, too, because that's where he worked.
Well, were there times in which you had to reshoot something because that either didn't work, or it's like, oh, let's get a better angle or something?
Oh, absolutely. You can't shoot if you want to just do something that's 14 karat gold. You'll be lucky if you get it done in the first run.
Mm-hmm. I was just listening to Michael Close talking about when he was doing an L&L one time, and he had to shoot 30 things in the span of, I think it was like a day and a half, including the explanations. And it was one of those things that had to be tight, had to be good. And so he just put things in little Ziploc bags. He put like three tricks at a time in a Ziploc, and another three tricks, and then all those into a larger bag. And so this way he would kind of take a break in between each three tricks. So he would kind of just focus on that little act and then the next little act, because you really can't get lightning in a bottle a second time, because I would think that the people, if they are going to reshoot that, to have the same kind of response and surprise is not going to be the same with the second or third take.
He was right. but that would happen, though, in filming Mullica or G. Marshall. Mm-hmm. There are things that didn't go, so you got to reshoot it again. Well,
yeah, like with J. Marshall's Table Crap. That was one of them I remember was a
funny. Yeah. That was funny. Typical Jay. But some of that stuff had to be shot again. Mm-hmm. But my daughter, Amy Jo, she was very instrumental with Gene Rump in doing, because she was into the video work and that type of thing with the, mm-hmm. with the TV studios. So just a matter of me bringing them in and turning it over to her and Gene Rump, and they got it done. And the product came out. So today, they're still popular, the DVDs now, but not like they were when they first came out.
No, of course they were. It was something new, back then, certainly. And but again, I was just wondering if there might have been something that comes to mind, a particular story that you remember when you got somebody in, or maybe had to change the last minute because they had a conflict and had to substitute somebody else, or anything come to mind as far as a story.
Well, here's the funniest story of all was when we brought G. Marshall in. From Chicago. Uh-huh. Max Armstrong was a professional magician here in Wichita, but he's also a captain in the police department. And Mac loved magic, and Max did. And he knew Jay. He knew how Jay was. Uh-huh. He said, let's bring in Jay in a funny, good way. I said, okay, what do you want to do? Well, he was a police captain. He says, well, I'll have the police meet him at the gate. And we'll arrest him, and we'll put him in the paddy wagon and drive him into Wichita. We'll handcuff him.
Okay.
So now Max stayed out of the scene because Jay knew Max. Uh-huh, uh-huh. So he had the guys showed him Jay's picture, and Jay gets off there playing, and they say, "Mr. Marshall, you're under arrest." And Jay looked at them. He says, "I'm sorry, you got the wrong guy."
Yeah.
So they put the cuffs on him. They put him in the paddy wagon, brought him into the hotel. He gets out of the paddy wagon. We're all standing there waiting, laughing. And Jay's got the handcuffs on. And that's the maddest I've ever seen Jay Marshall. But he took a good state because he thought it was a great con that got pulled on him.
He probably didn't see the humor in that when he was sitting in the back of that paddy wagon.
No, not until they opened the door and let him out.
Yeah.
That's a story. You couldn't do it today, but Max, when he was with, you couldn't do it if Max was still with the police department today. It's too precarious. Oh, that's the funniest one that comes to mind.
Yeah. Well, I know we were talking about things that you had carried that are unique to Stephen's Magic Emporium. One of them, you were aligned with Dr. Albo for a long number of years, and then had worked with putting out some of his beautiful props and some Aikido things and his books and everything. How did that relationship come about, and how did you get to publish his book?
Well, you're talking about the when you say the book, are you talking about the Albo books?
The Albo books, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that was a project that Doc had himself. He came out with those beautiful books. He printed them. He wrote them, edited it, printed them, the Albo books. I just had a good relationship with him, and he allowed us to sell them. And so I don't know exactly what I can say about Albo, except he was a great guy. He loved magic, and he was a friend to any magician. Mm-hmm. I talked to him, "Doc, I'm not feeling good. I got this he was going to have my best service. He was surgery. He was always there for me, and I never knew that. I thought he was with anybody that he knew in magic, he would help him with.
Mm-hmm. Well, for people listening who may not know or remember who Dr. Alba was, that among other things, he was the surgeon or the medical officer, I guess, for the San Francisco 49ers.
Or was it that or the Oakland Raiders?
You may be right. Maybe it was the Raiders. Yeah,
because he lived in Oakland.
Yeah, it was Oakland Raiders. You're right. Yeah. But he was the doctor for the team doctor, basically, in addition to his private practice and then magic and everything that he had put together then, too. So over the years, you've had a lot of really great products and things and people you've been aligned with and everything. Has there been, and you talk about that mentalism thing with the Joy Buzzer and everything, that's still a good seller. Over the years,
yes, absolutely.
What's been one of the best sellers or something that has been selling well, regardless whether it's brick and mortar or online?
Well, golly, there's so many good things, and we would like to think that our choice of magic to put out is a cut above the average stuff. There's so much schlock out there today, and made by, and we didn't have a lot of choices, did we, Scott? 30, 40 years ago, 50, finding quality magic, and it's just
Nielsen Worth made nice stuff.
Oh, yeah. You can find one or two, but most of it was, I don't want to mention the name of the company.
Sure.
But it's trying to find, and I would use Jay a lot. I got to give Jay Marshall more credit than what I've said through talking to you. Jay guided me so many times. I could call him, Jay, how do I get a hold of this? Is it worth me? And he would just give me information, and I would have friends. And even Roger Klaus would give me ideas of who I talked to bring in. So I was always asking people, what do you think? Who do you know? What do you think I should do? And you can ask people that, and they're pleased that you're asking them, and they always tell you what they think. So I was lucky to get the right answers back, and finding the Kenbrook line and getting Supreme Magic. I tied in Supreme over in England and got stuff from them too. So we had we got lucky. I don't like to carry schlock. We just got something. I've been around long enough in magic, I can tell something that's good or not good or crap.
That's true. And you've been the honest dealer, most honest dealer, it seems like, because you were just saying, well, I really don't want to mention names or anything. And that kind of reminded me of something else that so many years ago that I had asked you as a friend about something, say, well, I don't, talk about somebody else. If I don't have something nice to say, I'm just not going to say it. And I don't remember I think you had said something to the effect is that everybody is a customer or a potential customer. And I think whether you're a dealer, Joe, or you're not a dealer, you're just a human being, everyone's a customer to you. You're someone who you interact with. And so everyone you meet is a customer or could be. So in other words, that you may be passing someone on the street who's not a friend, but they might be a friend. And so it's best to be nice to everybody. And you have been that Mr. Nice Guy in our community that has been well loved for obvious reasons, throughout the decades.
Well, it's so nice to hear you say that. I'm sure that I've upset some people of not knowing that. I mean, there may be a few that I meant to upset, but it's still a fraternal feeling that I still have. But when a magician comes through Wichita and he stops, let's go to lunch, let's go to supper. I just remember how grateful I was when Vernon spent time with me and Slidini spent time with me. And I've got to tell you one funny story before we close this.
Yes.
Vernon Slidini. But Slidini I give credit for starting the Desert Magic Seminar, because he went to law. He came to Wichita. We lectured here. Spent 3 or 4 days with him, and he came back again. I said, why don't you go to Vegas? We'll go to Vegas with your name, and we'll bring the West Coast in to see you, because there's a lot of magicians out in California. He said, okay, it's a good thing you do. And at that time, if there was any profit, I didn't have to pay him a fee. I said, we'll just pay you. If there's any profit, I'll split it with you. He said, okay, good deal. So we advertised him, and he brought in people. He sure did. I think we had 90-some people that year. 90. And then the next year, I was going to bring him again, and he said, to his credit, he says, no, Joe, you can't bring me again. You must bring somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I want to bring you. Do you mind if I bring somebody else? And he says, no, who? I says, how about Vernon? You get Vernon and Slidini together, the two icons, one from the West Coast, one from the East Coast. It has a ring to it. He says, okay. He says, good. I have no problem with it. I said, good. I will pay you a fee. And, you know, because where I was, I wanted him to share. The first time when he went, we shared the profits.
Mm-hmm.
The next, when he said, no, it's time for you to do it by yourself now. You don't need me every year, because it won't come if you do me every year. So that's fine. But he came, and we paid him a fee, and Vernon came, and that was a great thing, to have Vernon and Slidini together.
It was.
Two icons. And one funny story, and I know we want to bring this to conclusion today, but one funny story is that Martha just loved Di Vernon. All the gals loved Vernon. You know, and he was a ladies' man in his day, but they got the... Vernon says, you want to play some gin? She says, okay, let's go, because Martha was a good gin player. So they go up to the room, and from the Latin Hotel, and they're playing gin rummy. So I go up to make sure everything's okay. Well, the door was open, and as I was walking down to get into the room, Martha is screaming, laughing. So I walk in the room, and she's standing up on the bed, and Vernon's trying to get her. I said, what the hell happened? And she says, I blitzed Di Vernon. He's mad at me. Blitz means under to nothing in gin rummy. So if Vernon was laughing, he was mad. Ever since then, he called her the card hustler whenever he saw her. Because she skinned him real quick, real good.
100 to nothing.
100 to nothing. The card shark. The card shark wasn't Vernon. It was my wife, Martha. Oh, Scott, so many stories. But I've told you enough. You've got enough now.
Well, it's been wonderful. Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it. And before we do close, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And I always like to ask my guests, what is it that's your philosophy of life? What is your magic word or phrase? What do you live by when you wake up in the morning? What is it that gives you joy or... get you out of bed and makes you want to.
I just love the magic. Every day there's something new coming in. There's a magician coming through town. There's another routine. I love to perform at all, but I can't. When you run a business, you can't do what you did when you didn't run a business.
Mm-hmm.
And I just enjoy it so much. I learned a long time ago, if you do what you love, it's never work. And it's so true. It's so true. I mean, I'm 84 now and still going. And it's magic that's kept me alive.
And will for hopefully another 84 years. Best to you and Martha and the family.
Thanks, Scott. Stay well.
Okay, Joe.
See you, buddy.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Wow. Thanks very much, Joe. That was just a delightful chat we had and a great opportunity to catch up. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, we never really got around to talking about the Gemini Network. And there were so many other things that we could have discussed, but there were stories further that I know that you would have loved to share if we only had more time. But don't we always wish we had more time? But thank you for the precious time that you had given us. That means both me and all the listeners then as well. So thank you for your time and your words and your friendship. I appreciate that, Joe. And also, I want to encourage all of the listeners to subscribe to the weekly pod letter. And if you just go to the magicwordpodcast.com website, you will see there an opportunity to subscribe. It could be that you'll have a little pop-up even that could come onto your screen. It'll say, subscribe to the pod letter. It's just a weekly thing that keeps you up to date, lets you know who is on this week and who's coming up next week, and perhaps some suggestions from the archives of some of the podcast episodes you may have missed. And so, until next week, stay well. Get booked. And remember, if you do what you love, you'll never work. This is Scotty out.